Chapter 8. That year, towards the breaking up of the southwest monsoon, disquieting rumors reached Samber. Captain Ford, coming up to Almayer's house for an evening's chat, brought late numbers of the Straits Times giving the news of a Chine war, and of the unsuccessful Dutch expedition. The Nakotas of the rare trading process ending the river paid visits to Lacamba, discussing with that potentate the unsettled state of affairs, and wagged their heads gravely over the recital of Orang Blanda exaction, severity, and general tyranny, as exemplified in the total stoppage of gunpowder trade, and the rigorous visiting of all suspicious craft trading in the Straits of Macassar. Even the loyal soul of Lacamba was stirred into a state of inward discontent by the withdrawal of his license for powder, and by the abrupt confiscation of 150 barrels of that commodity by the gunboat Princess Amelia, when, after a hazardous voyage, it had almost reached the mouth of the river. The unpleasant news was given him by Rashid, who, after the unsuccessful issue of his matrimonial projects, had made a long voyage amongst the islands for trading purposes, had bought the powder for his friend, and was overhauled and deprived of it on his return, when actually congratulating himself on his acuteness in avoiding detection. Rashid's wrath was principally directed against Almayer, whom he suspected of having notified the Dutch authorities of the desultory warfare carried on by the Arabs, and the Raja with the upriver Dayak tribes. To Rashid's great surprise, the Raja received his complaints very coldly, and showed no signs of vengeful disposition towards the white man. In truth, Lacamba knew very well that Almayer was perfectly innocent of any meddling in state affairs, and besides, his attitude towards that much persecuted individual was wholly changed in consequence of a reconciliation effected between him and his old enemy by Almayer's newly found friend, Dane Maroola. Almayer had now a friend. Shortly after Rashid's departure on his commercial journey, Nina, drifting slowly with the tide in the canoe on her return home after one of her solitary excursions, heard in one of the small creeks a splashing, as if of heavy ropes dropping in the water, and the prolonged song of Malay seamen, when some heavy pulling is to be done. Through the thick fringe of bushes hiding the mouth of the creek, she saw the tall spars of some European-rigged sailing vessel overtopping the summits of the Nipa Palms. A brig was being hauled out of the small creek into the main stream. The sun had set, and during the short moments of twilight Nina saw the brig, aided by the evening breeze and the flowing tide, head towards Samber under her set foresail. The girl turned her canoe out of the main river into one of the many narrow channels amongst the wooded islets, and paddled vigorously over the black and sleepy backwaters towards Samber. Her canoe brushed the water palms, skirted the short spaces of muddy bank, where sedate alligators looked at her with lazy unconcern, and, just as darkness was setting in, shot out into the broad junction of the two main branches of the river, where the brig was already at anchor with sails furled, yards squared, and decks seemingly untenanted by any human being. Nina had to cross the river and pass pretty close to the brig in order to reach home on the low promontory between the two branches of the Pantai. Up both branches, in the houses built on the banks, and over the water, the lights twinkled already, reflected in the still waters below. The hum of voices, the occasional cry of a child, the rapid and abruptly interrupted roll of a wooden drum, together with some distant hailing in the darkness by the returning fishermen, reached her over the broad expanse of the river. She hesitated a little before crossing, the sight of such an unusual object as an European-rigged vessel causing her some uneasiness, but the river in its wide expansion was dark enough to render a small canoe invisible. She urged her small craft with swift strokes of her paddle, kneeling in the bottom and bending forward, to catch any suspicious sound, while she steered towards the little jetty of Lingard and Company, to which the strong light of the paraffin lamp shining on the whitewashed veranda of Almayer's bungalow served as a convenient guide. The jetty itself, under the shadow of the bank overgrown by drooping bushes, was hidden in darkness. Before even she could see it, she heard the hollow bumping of a large boat against its rotten posts, and heard also the murmur of whispered conversation in that boat whose white paint and great dimensions, faintly visible on near approach, made her rightly guess that it belonged to the brig just anchored. Stopping her course by a rapid motion of her paddle, with another swift stroke she sent it whirling away from the wharf, and steered for a little rivulet which gave access to the back courtyard of the house. She landed at the muddy head of the creek, and made her way towards the house over the trodden grass of the courtyard. To the left, from the cooking shed, shone a red glare through the banana plantation she skirted, and the noise of feminine laughter reached her from there in the silent evening. She rightly judged her mother was not near, laughter and Mrs. Almayer not being close neighbors. She must be in the house, thought Nina, as she ran lightly up the inclined plane of shaky planks leading to the back door of the narrow passage dividing the house in two. Outside the doorway, in the black shadow, stood the faithful Ali. "Who is there?" asked Nina. "A great Malay man has come," answered Ali, in a tone of suppressed excitement. "He is a rich man. There are 6 men with lances. Real soldat, you understand. And his dress is very brave. I have seen his dress. It shines. What jewels! Don't go there, Mem Nina." Tuan said not. "But the old Mem is gone. Tuan will be angry. Merciful Allah! What jewels that man has got!" Nina slipped past the outstretched hand of the slave into the dark passage where, in the crimson glow of the hanging curtain, close by its other end, she could see a small dark form crouching near the wall. Her mother was feasting her eyes and ears with what was taking place on the front veranda, and Nina approached to take her share in the rare pleasure of some novelty. She was met by her mother's extended arm, and by a low murmured warning, not to make a noise. "Have you seen them, mother?" asked Nina, in a breathless whisper. Mrs. Almayer turned her face towards the girl, and her sunken eyes shone strangely in the red half-light of the passage. "I saw him," she said, in an almost inaudible tone, pressing her daughter's hand with her bony fingers. "Great Raja has come to Sambar, a son of heaven," muttered the old woman to herself. "Go away, girl." The two women stood close to the curtain, Nina wishing to approach the rent in the stuff, and her mother defending the position with angry obstinacy. On the other side there was a lull in the conversation, but the breathing of several men, the occasional light tinkling of some ornaments, the clink of metal scabbards, or of brass serai vessels passed from hand to hand, was audible during the short pause. The women struggled silently, when there was a shuffling noise, and the shadow of Almayer's burly form fell on the curtain. The women ceased struggling and remained motionless. Almayer had stood up to answer his guest, turning his back to the doorway, unaware of what was going on the other side. He spoke in a tone of regretful irritation. "You have come to the wrong house, Tuan Marula, if you want to trade as you say. I was a trader once, not now, whatever you may have heard about me in Macassar. And if you want anything, you will not find it here. I have nothing to give, and want nothing myself. You should go to the Raja here. You can see in the daytime his houses across the river, there, where those fires are burning on the shore. He will help you and trade with you. Or, better still, go to the Arabs over there," he went on bitterly, pointing with his hand towards the houses of Sambar. "Dullah is the man you want. There is nothing he would not buy, and there is nothing he would not sell. Believe me, I know him well." He waited for an answer a short time, then added, "All that I have said is true, and there is nothing more." Nina, held back by her mother, heard a soft voice reply with a calm evenness of intonation peculiar to the better class Malays who would doubt a white Tuan's words. "A man seeks his friends where his heart tells him. Is this not true also? I have come, although so late, for I have something to say which you may be glad to hear. Tomorrow I will go to the Sultan. A trader wants the friendship of great men. Then I shall return here to speak serious words, if Tuan permits. I shall not go to the Arabs, Their lies are very great. What are they? Shalaka. Almayer's voice sounded a little more pleasantly in reply. Well, as you like. I can hear you tomorrow at any time, if you have anything to say. Bah! After you have seen the Sultan Lakamba, you will not want to return here, Inchai Dane. You will see. Only mind, I will have nothing to do with Lakamba. You may tell him so. What is your business with me, after all? Tomorrow we talk, Tuan. Now I know you, answered the Malay. I speak English a little, so we can talk, and nobody will understand. And then, he interrupted himself suddenly, asking surprised, what's that noise, Tuan? Almayer had also heard the increasing noise of the scuffle recommenced on the women's side of the curtain. Evidently Nina's strong curiosity was on the point of overcoming Mrs. Almayer's exalted sense of social proprieties. Hard breathing was distinctly audible, and the curtain shook during the contest, which was mainly physical, although Mrs. Almayer's voice was heard in angry remonstrance with its usual want of strictly logical reasoning, but with the well-known richness of invective. You shameless woman! Are you a slave? Shouted shrilly the irate matron. Ail your face, abandoned wretch! You white snake, I will not let you! Almayer's face expressed annoyance, and also doubt, as to the advisability of interfering between mother and daughter. He glanced at his Malay visitor, who was waiting silently for the end of the uproar in an attitude of amused expectation, and waving his hand contemptuously he murmured, "It is nothing. Some women." The Malay nodded his head gravely, and his face assumed an expression of serene indifference, as etiquette demanded after such an explanation. The contest was ended behind the curtain, and evidently the younger will had its way, for the rapid shuffle and click of Mrs. Almayer's high-heeled sandals died away in the distance. The tranquilized master of the house was going to resume the conversation when, struck by an unexpected change in the expression of his guest's countenance, he turned his head and saw Nina standing in the doorway. After Mrs. Almayer's retreat from the field of battle, Nina, with a contemptuous exclamation, "It's only a traitor," had lifted the conquered curtain and now stood in full light, framed in the dark background on the passage, her lips slightly parted, her hair in disorder after the exertion, the angry gleam not yet faded out of her glorious and sparkling eyes. She took in at a glance the group of white-clad lancemen standing motionless in the shadow of the far-off end of the veranda, and her gaze rested curiously on the chief of that imposing cortege. He stood, almost facing her, a little on one side, and struck by the beauty of the unexpected apparition had bent low, elevating his joint hands above his head in a sign of respect accorded by Malays only to the great of this earth. The crude light of the lamp shone on the gold embroidery of his black silk jacket, broke in a thousand sparkling rays on the jeweled hilt of his crisp protruding from under the many folds of the red sarong gathered into a sash around his waist, and played on the precious stones of the many rings on his dark fingers. He straightened himself up quickly after the low bow, putting his hand with a graceful ease on the hilt of his heavy short sword ornamented with brilliantly dyed fringes of horsehair. Nina, hesitating on the threshold, saw an erect lithe figure of medium height with a breadth of shoulder suggesting great power. Under the folds of a blue turban, whose fringed ends hung gracefully over the left shoulder, was a face full of determination, and expressing a reckless good humor, not devoid, however, of some dignity. The squareness of lower jaw, the full red lips, the mobile nostrils, and the proud carriage of the head, gave the impression of a being half savage, untamed, perhaps cruel, and corrected the liquid softness of the almost feminine eye, that general characteristic of the race. Now, the first surprise over, Nina saw those eyes fixed upon her with such an uncontrolled expression of admiration and desire, that she felt a hitherto unknown feeling of shyness, mixed with alarm and some delight, enter and penetrate her whole being. Confused by those unusual sensations, she stopped in the doorway and instinctively drew the lower part of the curtain across her face, leaving only half a rounded cheek, a straight dress, and one eye exposed, wherewith to contemplate the gorgeous and bold being so unlike in appearance to the rare specimens of traitors as he had seen before on that same veranda. Dame Marula, dazzled by the unexpected vision, forgot the confused Elmayer, forgot his brig, his escort staring in open-mouthed admiration, the object of his visit and all things else, in his overpowering desire to prolong the contemplation of so much loveliness met so suddenly in such an unlikely place as he thought. "It is my daughter," said Elmayer, in an embarrassed manner. "He is of no consequence. White women have their customs, as you know too, and having traveled much, as you say. However, it is late. We will finish our talk tomorrow." Dane bent low, trying to convey in a last glance towards the girl the bold expression of his overwhelming admiration. The next minute he was shaking Almayer's hand with grave courtesy, his face wearing a look of stolid unconcern as to any feminine presence. His men filed off, and he followed them quickly, closely attended by a thick-set, savage-looking Sumatrese he had introduced before as the commander of his brig. Nina walked to the balustrade of the veranda, and saw the sheen of moonlight on the steel spearheads, and heard the rhythmic jingle of brass anklets as the men moved in single file towards the jetty. The boat shoved off after a little while, looming large in the full light of the moon, a black shapeless mass in the slight haze hanging over the water. Nina fancied she could distinguish the graceful figure of the trader standing erect in the stern sheets, but in a little while all the outlines got blurred, confused, and soon disappeared in the folds of white vapor shrouding the middle of the river. Almayer had approached his daughter, and leaning with both arms over the rail, was looking moodily down on the heap of rubbish and broken bottles at the foot of the veranda. "What was all that noise just now?" he growled peevishly, without looking up. "Confound you and your mother. What did she want? What did you come out for?" "She did not want to let me come out," said Nina. "He is angry. She says the man just gone to some Raja. I think she is right now." "I believe all you women are crazy," snarled Almayer. "Hats that to you, to her, to anybody? The man wants to collect trepang and birds' nests on the islands. He told me so, that Raja of yours. He will come tomorrow. I want you both to keep away from the house, and let me attend to my business in peace." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.